You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, a look at Alzheimer's disease. The death of President Reagan last month focused new urgency on finding a cure for the disease. His widow Nancy called for more research using stem cells. But with stem cell technology still in its infancy, many scientists are putting their hopes on more conventional drugs. In the next few weeks, clinical trials for a drug that might stop the formation of plaques will get underway. Millions of people worldwide suffer from Alzheimer's, a progressive illness that robs sufferers of their memory, eventually leading to death. The Alzheimer's Association expects that number to double or triple in the coming decades as post-World War II baby boomers age. So for the rest of this hour, we're going to take a look at the latest treatments for Alzheimer's, what we have now, what might be headed in our way. I invite you to call in with your questions, but remember to keep in mind that we can't ask our doctors to diagnose you over the radio. It's not ethical to do that, so please keep your questions in a more general nature. Let me introduce my guests. Stephen Dukoski is a professor and chairman of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pittsburgh. He's also director of Alzheimer's Disease Research Center there and a board member of the Alzheimer's Association. He joins us by phone from Pittsburgh. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Dukoski.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Stephen Ferris is the Gerald J. and Dorothy R. Friedman Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at the Silberstein Institute for Aging and Dementia at NYU School of Medicine. He joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Ferris.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Ferris, a lot of attention has been drawn to stem cells recently with the idea that they might hold the potential cure for Alzheimer's. Of course, Nancy Reagan is championing the cause, and now John Kerry has pledged his support for stem cell research. But an article in the Washington Post this week quoted several scientists saying that stem cells are unlikely to help with Alzheimer's. The article says, quote, "It's a distortion that some admit is not being aggressively corrected by scientists." Can you agree with any or all of that?
Well, I would agree in general that stem cells are not in the forefront of current therapy research for Alzheimer's. But I think down the road, they're certainly that approach should not be ruled out, and this sort of research in general for degenerative diseases should indeed be pursued.
Why are stem cells more of a challenge?
Mainly because of the nature of Alzheimer's disease specifically, in that it involves pathology widely distributed throughout the brain and various subtypes of nerve cells are affected, so that this sort of simple, straightforward approach of replacing a certain type of cell with using stem cell technology would be much more difficult, though certainly not impossible, in the case of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dukoski, any comment?
Just a few. I think Steve handled the major piece of it, which is that Alzheimer's disease is a diffuse brain disorder, unlike some other disorders in the body and in the brain, which are limited to specific cells in relatively small areas, and therefore you might be able to simply put cells in to replace cells or chemical messengers that have been lost. Alzheimer's is a neurodegenerative disease that isn't global. It has specific pathways and interrupts. So it'd be like looking at the road map of your state and then all of a sudden having just the blue roads disappear, mm-hmm. whereas the other roads stay there. So Alzheimer's patients have normal strength and normal sensation and normal vision. For the most part, their coordination is okay until late in the disease. To be able to direct a stem cell to replace a cell that is dead or dying means the ability to engineer them to change to different kinds of cells with different chemical messengers in geographically different places in the brain. And since most people, that is a task that is theoretically, we like to think about it on the drawing boards, but we do not have it yet. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that we would have to have a delivery system for Alzheimer's patients that we very much hope would not depend on having to do a craniotomy or open a hole in the brain to put the cells in. We would, in the best of possible worlds, inject it into a vein and have the cells make their way to the brain to do the substituting job they have to do. Technically, these are daunting, and that's why the medication route appears to be a much more, hold out the possibility of much sooner success in AD.
Are there any medications that offer any effectiveness right now?
Well, there are four drugs approved. I should say five. One is very seldom used. It was the first drug developed over a decade ago. There are four drugs that are used, three of which are the same class and one of which is a different class. They've all shown symptomatic effects in trials, carefully designed experimental trials, but they are just that. They are symptomatic. They are not medications that actually interfere with or slow down the actual progression of the brain changes, and then, of course, we'd hope slow down or stop the memory loss and the thinking change. Those are the drugs that are just now coming into experimental trials.
Mm-hmm. And how do they work?
Well, they work in a variety of ways. Just as Dr. Ferris mentioned that there are many different diffuse areas of the brain affected, there are a variety of processes that go on in the brain. We've actually spent the last 15 years sorting out what is the nature of the inflammatory change, what are the proteins that have somehow and mysteriously gone awry and resulted in the deposition of proteins that are folded wrong and just sort of pile up in the brain and evoke an inflammatory reaction. Mm-hmm. Every time we learn about one of these pathological processes, immediately other people will say, well, if we could interfere with that process here, we could stop the process or at least we could slow it down. So there are medications or strategies for developing medications that interfere with any one of a number of the changes that lead to the deposition of the protein amyloid. There are less well-developed approaches that are going to try and stop the other major pathology that Alzheimer described, that are what are called neurofibrillary tangles, folded up proteins inside neurons. And then there are a variety of anti-inflammatory and antioxidant strategies, which while they're not specific to Alzheimer's disease, we hope would quiet down the brain pathology and slow down the progression of clinical change.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any approval of these drugs? For example, the glutamates, the anti-glutamate drugs in the brain?
There is one drug that addresses the glutamatergic messenger system in the brain, and that's a drug called memantine. It's the fourth of the currently used medications. It, too, thus far has only shown symptomatic benefits, and like the other group of drugs, the so-called cholinesterase inhibitors, the effects, while better than placebo, are fairly modest. But what's particularly interesting about this most recent compound is that because it addresses a different system and doesn't interact with the other drugs, it can be used in addition to the first three drugs, and therefore you can sort of begin to add up two drugs and get overall, hopefully, a little better effect. But overall, even with a combination presently, the extent to which we can impact on the symptoms is still fairly modest.
I think another thing to consider is the fact that with the comments about combination therapy for the two different kinds of medications for Alzheimer's disease, most of us believe that because of the variety of pathologies that go on, the variety of changes that have occurred that aren't normal in the brain in AD, that we'll probably treat it like we treat heart disease or try to prevent heart disease, that we'll use several different drugs that work in different ways and that hopefully will be synergistic in either slowing down or preventing the disease. Mm-hmm. So just as we use routinely certain kinds of enzyme inhibitors and diuretics and so forth and cholesterol-lowering drugs for heart disease, we will probably use antioxidants, anti-inflammatory drugs, anti-amyloid drugs, perhaps separately neurofibrillary tangle drugs, along with the symptomatic drugs in patients who have the symptomatic disease, all in an effort to achieve some kind of synergy in slowing down the disease or even bringing it to a halt if we can.
Are these drugs all under test now, for the different methods of attack?
There are all of the strategies that Dr. Tikosky mentioned are currently being studied in fairly sizable clinical trials. It takes a bit longer and bigger studies to address the question of slowing the disease down. You have to study for at least a year or two in order to see if the rate of decline is affected in patients who have symptoms.
Because you can't go in and look at the brain itself. You have to look at the symptoms.
That's correct.
Yeah.
We currently don't have a valid way to go inside the brain and actually measure the disease. We have to depend on measuring the effect of the disease, which is the clinical symptoms affecting memory and other cognitive functions and behavior and so forth.
Dr. Dukoski, when we talked with you almost 4 years ago, you told us about a vaccine that had just passed its first clinical trial. Any update on that?
Well, when we spoke a number of years ago, that vaccine, which was an anti-amyloid vaccine, had just completed safety trials with no indication of any difficulties. And as many of your audience knows, it was placed into clinical trial. About 300 people in the U.S. and Europe in a multicenter trial received up to three injections of the immunization itself, which was actually with the abnormal protein amyloid, and about 75 people received placebo.
Mm-hmm.
About a year or so into the trial, about 18 people in various places around the world developed an inflammatory reaction in the brain to the vaccination. And so the trial was stopped, that is, future injections were stopped, although people continued to be followed to see how they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that particular vaccine type, it's technically not a vaccine since it's not a biological creature, but just a chemical, it's more of an an immunization, that particular chemical won't be used for future immunizations, but a number of groups are hard at work, including the company that did the original study, trying to find a safer vaccine that would produce the antibody to amyloid and help protect against it without producing the negative inflammatory reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's happened is that we vaccinate people to have them make antibody so that the antibody goes into the abnormal protein and identifies it, and then the immune system removes it.
Right.
The alternative strategy would be to simply give antibody itself to stop to provide it immediately to hopefully have access to the proteins that you want to remove. And the first of a number of trials is underway now. Some are underway simply with immunoglobulin G or IgG, which is commonly used in a number of other neurological diseases such as multiple sclerosis and certain kinds of neuropathies. But there's also a trial of a highly specific anti-amyloid antibody in patients. Those are just safety trials. They're not trials to see if it works. And these are just on the cusp. These are, as we talked about 4 years ago, the leading edge of the product of all the research that's been done over the past several years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd make two more footnotes to that. The first is that one of the things that will change in the next 2 weeks is that the World Alzheimer's Conference that's sponsored by the U.S. Alzheimer's Association will take place in Philadelphia. About 4,000 people from all over the world will be there just to discuss Alzheimer's disease and the latest treatment findings. We'll learn an update on a variety of the imaging, the therapeutic tests, and so forth at that meeting in Philadelphia from the 17th to the 22nd. At that meeting, as well as very recently, the first studies that showed that we could image amyloid inside the brain, one of the major targets. You can argue about whether it's the major target, but it's clearly one that we will work on until we have answered the question of whether getting it out or stopping it will help stop the disease. We now can see it on PET scan and have initiated studies to see how it changes over time and if with these anti-amyloid therapies.
Mm-hmm.
We could use that as a marker rather than have to wait a couple of years to see if people slowed down in their thinking function to detect or determine that a drug was effective.
Very interesting. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you'd have a tool actually to, we said before, there's no way to see if it was effective, but you could actually now image the brain. Very interesting.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Well, I could interject
one
corollary to what Dr. Dukoski just mentioned. If we had this sort of marker that could identify people who were beginning to accumulate amyloid in the brain, it would greatly shortcut the ability to test future treatments that may prevent the disease. Because currently there's a movement towards so-called primary prevention trials to see if you can reduce future occurrence of patients with symptoms. And these trials are huge in size. They take 4 or 5 years to conduct, with thousands of patients and thousands of individuals enrolled, and they're extremely costly and time-consuming. If we had a way to identify early pathology in people before they had symptoms, these would be the people in much smaller numbers and for shorter lengths of time that could be tested with potential preventative treatments, and it would greatly shortcut the process of developing truly effective treatments.
Well said.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Martin in Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Martin.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
I myself have an official diagnosis of dementia. What I had is normal pressure hydrocephalus, and I've had a shunt. I'm in a study at the University of Virginia with to differentiate Alzheimer's from this normal pressure hydrocephalus. I've had a brain biopsy and that kind of thing, you know, different the chromosome studies and various things. So it's interesting. There are a lot of people walking around with normal pressure hydrocephalus who are, you know, confused or whatever it is, and being on serotonin reuptake inhibitors and various things.
I think you're saying they're being misdiagnosed. Is that it?
I think, well, they may be,
yeah.
Because the effects are the same. The loss of this kind of animal function of the lower brain, where you know where you put things, it's organizational things, it's mm-hmm. you know, your automatic recording things. All of these things are not working properly.
We have to go to a break. Let me get a reaction into your comments. Very interesting, doctors. Any comment there?
There is a classic triad of symptoms for normal pressure hydrocephalus dementia problems with continence, with holding one's urine, and gait disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
There is a surgical intervention for normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is helpful most commonly if you have all three of those symptoms. But sometimes the symptoms of the triad, as it's called, are subtle. And sometimes it is a struggle to get to an accurate diagnosis or someone who will recognize those symptoms. It's pretty much started by characteristically an imaging finding on neuroimaging, and now pretty much everyone who has dementia gets an imaging study that ought to make it easier to get people to the right diagnosis. But it can be very challenging in some people.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break and come back and take more of your questions, talking about Alzheimer's disease this hour with Stephen Dukoski, who is professor and chairman of the Department of Neurology at University of Pittsburgh, and Stephen Ferris, who is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine. So stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Alzheimer's disease with my guest, Stephen Dukoski, professor and chairman of the Department of Neurology, University of Pittsburgh, Stephen Ferris, who is director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at New York University School of Medicine. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk about, we mentioned it briefly, and I know there are tests going on to test whether these statins, these, you know, people are taking for high cholesterol levels, they might be effective in treating Alzheimer's disease.
Yes. There's a sort of converging set of evidence from several sources suggesting that lowering cholesterol might either reduce the risk for Alzheimer's disease or slow the progression of the disease in people who already have the diagnosis. The kinds of evidence comes, first of all, from looking at data sets on people, some of whom have been taking statins for various reasons, usually high cholesterol, and some who have not, and noting that in general there seems to be a statistically lower occurrence of future Alzheimer's disease. And then scientists in the laboratory have shown in various ways something of a linkage between high cholesterol in the brain and the processing of that bad protein, beta amyloid. So it leads at least to the hypothesis that lowering cholesterol in people people with Alzheimer's disease or in people at risk for Alzheimer's disease might have some benefit. And the result has been to develop some clinical trials to actually test this hypothesis. One initial sort of preliminary study in a relatively small number of subjects, people with Alzheimer's disease, did suggest that there may be a slowing down of the disease over a one-year treatment period. So this is not definitive, but is now being followed up in several larger trials with statins, and these are ongoing. We don't have results yet.
Yeah, there are a couple of things about the statins that hold promise, and Steve also, I think, gave you the appropriate caution with respect to assumptions. The observational studies done in people who are in large-scale trials or in populations just being observed are people who were placed on the statins because they had elevated cholesterol. The studies that will be done under careful trial conditions, where some people get placebo and some people get the actual active drug, will be done in people who have normal cholesterol. And we don't yet know whether or not, assuming that the effect that was seen in observational studies in people with high cholesterol was true, we don't know whether or not that same protection might be afforded to people whose cholesterols are normal, and there are a variety of issues about how low you should drive one's cholesterol with the statins if it's already normal, although it does look increasingly safe to drive cholesterols down lower. So there, in addition to the fact that cholesterol has some effect on the metabolism of amyloid, the one of the suspect proteins in the disease, it also has a variety of other effects, including the tendency to help blood vessels open to increase flow, some anti-inflammatory effects, and some other positive effects that seem like they should help with AD. Mm-hmm. The caution that we gave, which is why we're still studying and cautiously advising people through the Maintain Your Brain program that the Alzheimer's Association has tried to get developed and moving, is to not make any assumptions that these drugs would work for you, but rather maintain as healthy a lifestyle as you can until we have the answers. There's no question that if it turned out that these were effective in prevention, and that was the suggestion from the studies that Steve was talking about from the looking at the population, it would be immensely helpful as a first way to at least understand ways that we could stop the disease. We ought to know in another, what, year or two, Steve, if the two major studies would show that there was a slowing of progression in people with the disease. There are two major trials underway now in the U.S. To try and determine that.
Well, shouldn't you be able to determine that just by a population of people with low cholesterol levels having lower incidences of Alzheimer's?
The overlap of cholesterols in people in the country is far too great, and the time that you would get a cholesterol variable, you'd have to do fastings and so forth. But the variability, when we talk about higher or lower cholesterol, we can only use that as the association that says people were attracted the attention of their physician and were put on statins. But the variability is so large that you can't use that as a diagnostic suggestion.
I got you. 1-800-989-8255. Barbara in San Diego, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
My husband is 79 years old, and he's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. When he was younger, he had 165 IQ and went to an IGC class. Through the years that I've been married to him, I have noticed that he has always had sort of an absent-minded professor syndrome. He has difficulty organizing. He forgets a lot of things. He misnames things, like if something's pronounced one way, he'll pronounce it the wrong way, and he did that when he was in his 30s and 40s. It seems to me that what he has is a progressive disease that I have seen symptoms of over 30 or 40 years, and I was wondering if there's any information on that.
Gentlemen?
Do you want to take that one, Steve?
I was hoping you would.
I will if you want, but the word-finding difficulties in the neuropsychology, I was trying to be polite.
Yeah, well, we all have some of these problems, certainly the kind of symptoms that become prominent in the early stage of Alzheimer's disease are almost universal in the population, and we all start noticing them in our 40s and 50s and 60s in particular. So it's really a matter of degree, and I don't, it's impossible to, really definitively comment on the specific case that you're describing.
Do you see any relationship between this and Asperger's and ADD?
No, we don't. What happens is if they co-occur, we are so eager to learn more about both attention deficit disorder and Asperger's syndrome, a variant of that, and Alzheimer's disease, that we immediately want to know whether or not there is an overlap. But no one has been able to determine that there are significant overlaps, at least as far as the causes are concerned. I think I would go out on a limb and suggest that someone who had an IQ of 165 will look different when they develop their Alzheimer's disease anyway, because people who have that level of intelligence are used to having their brains unconsciously as well as consciously solve problems. And so when they begin to decline, they look different than many people because their brains find unique ways to solve problems, and therefore they have a very uneven look to their changes in thinking function. I also had to smile because when you made those comments about being absent-minded, being messy, misplacing things, and using the wrong word, you probably had 1,000 people in the country saying, that sounds just like either me or my husband. And those, what Steve said about the overlap, this very frustrating overlap for us between normal aging changes, which occur in language like this, which occur in cholesterol, and which occur in the shrinkage of the brain or atrophy that everybody gets, like they get wrinkles as they get older, but which is more pronounced in Alzheimer's patients. There is this large overlap with aging changes, and what we have to do is try to sift out and separate people who are on their way to disease from people who have normal changes in aging, or at least what we currently regard as normal changes in aging.
Thank you for calling, Barbara.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Bye. Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. The progression and exactly what Alzheimer's is, I mean, in terms of, is it plaques or is it the knots in the neurons? We don't know exactly yet. Correct? Which comes first, chicken, egg? That sort of thing.
There is an inordinate amount of discussion, even to the point of people pounding on tables about what we call first cause.
Mm-hmm.
That is, what started it. And I think that's actually a non-starter argument for us. We know what the markers are of the disease. We know that every patient with Alzheimer's disease has these amyloid plaques or senile plaques. That's how we actually define the disease neuropathologically. We know that virtually all people have neurofibrillary tangles, and actually they appear in their number and density in the brain to correlate more with the behavioral changes or the loss of memory than the plaques do. But the plaques appear to be, or the amyloid protein changes appear to be, in a number of cases such as genetic disorders and Down syndrome, to always be present. And that's why the people who argue that amyloid somehow goes wrong first continue to make the claim that that is the primary problem. We do know that amyloid is a very harmful protein, and we know that neurofibrillary tangles are very, very disruptive to brain function. So to say that you have to find out which one is first, actually we have laid aside as a science issue, but all of the activities that we've talked about, the interventions we've talked about, are all directed ultimately toward either stopping plaque development and progression or tangle development and progression. In a sense, my view of this is, you know, I don't care what started it when presented with a patient who has it. I want to stop it or slow it down. And we may never sort out exactly which one comes first, and it may well be that they somehow co-evolve together, that you have to be vulnerable to one, and if one goes bad, the other also cascades down. So almost everybody gets tangles when they get older. Not everybody gets plaques.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
There's also, I believe, and it's not my particular area of expertise, but as I understand it, there is a kind of commonality, in a sense, between both the plaques and the tangles, in the sense that both represent a process of abnormal protein folding. So in a way, they are, at least in that conceptual way, part of a similar pathologic process.
Mm-hmm. You know, people would say, well, can't you just get something to dissolve those plaques?
Well, the plaques are made up of very small proteins, protein building blocks really called peptides, which glom together into fibers. we think that the individual amyloid molecules, what's called the beta amyloid or the A-beta, is a bad actor. We don't know what it does in the normal brain. Everybody has a little bit of it. Alzheimer's patients have a lot more. We think by itself, in singular form, it may be dangerous, and when it comes together in groups of one or two, it may also be dangerous. And then when it gets to the fibrillar form, because it links together like a daisy chain, that's when the immune system notices it and attacks it, and that's one of the reasons we use anti-immune drugs, because the immune system tries to destroy it and can't. Some of the new drugs coming on the market are attempts to block the fibrillization from occurring, to stop the molecules from sticking to each other. And the anti-amyloid antibody was actually designed to try and, if not dissolve the plaques, at least allow antibody to grab each molecule and then let the immune system take it away, which in a sense would be dissolving it. In the few people who have died and been autopsied who were in the vaccination study, and I believe there are four cases so far that have come to autopsy, a number of those have shown either significant or almost total clearing of the amyloid from the brain samples in some regions, but not others. What we don't know yet, and that may come out at the conference in Philadelphia, in the International Alzheimer's Conference, is whether or not there was a behavioral change in those people. Because although we talked about the biomarkers and PET scanning with amyloid to tell us whether or not somebody has a lot of it in their brain or not, this might give us the opportunity to learn whether or not we can move amyloid out, and it's accompanied by improvement or slowing down of the change in behavior or the change in thinking function over time.
Well, we'll just have to wait for that meeting.
There are going to be a number of things that we hope will come out at that meeting. There have been small preliminary reports, for example, from that vaccine trial that have suggested that some people, if they had high antibody titers, that is, if they had high levels of antibody, not everybody makes the same amount of antibody in response to a vaccination, that if you had high levels, that you had a slower loss of function, and that if you didn't make quite as much antibody, that you had a the regular rate of decline in AD. It was only from about 30 of the 300 people who were vaccinated. So, and we have seen small numbers of cases somehow have a statistical effect, and then when you get the whole group, you lose the effect. So we're all waiting to see whether or not those data will be presented at this meeting.
We'll have to wait ourselves, and we'll pick that up when that meeting happens. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for taking time to talk with us. Stephen Ferris, the Gerald J. and Dorothy R. Friedman Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at the Silberstein Institute for Aging and Dementia at NYU School of Medicine. Stephen Dukoski, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurology, University of Pittsburgh. He's also Director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center there and a board member of the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you again for joining us. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Altman, and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. Our intern is Julie Kalin. You can surf over to our website at Science Friday, and you can also download past editions of Science Friday there and also take them away on your iPod or your Audible.com player. Also, you can leave us email there, and all the links we talked about, if you missed them, they're up there for you to take advantage of. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.